Greetings and welcome to the Beacon Broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church on Kirkpatrick Road in Burlington, North Carolina. The Beacon Broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. If you'd like to correspond with Pastor Barkman and the Beacon Broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201. The Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201. Now with today's message from God's Word, here is Pastor Greg Barkman.
Well, thank you for joining me on this Sunday, November 3 edition of the Beacon Broadcast. We are, as you know, working our way through the book of Acts, and most lately have been following the ministry of the Apostle Paul. You remember, don't you, that the book of Acts concentrates upon the ministry of two apostles. Now, there are a lot of other things as well, and I'm not saying that that's all that's in the book of Acts, but the first 12 chapters or so focus primarily upon the ministry of the Apostle Peter. And then chapter 13 and following primarily centers upon the ministry of the Apostle Paul. Again, you will not find that as a hard and fast rule, but that is the general outline of the book of Acts. First, the ministry of Peter. Secondly, the ministry of Paul. And of course, because we are now in chapter 18, we are well into the section that focuses upon the ministry of the Apostle Paul. And we've been following him now on his second missionary journey. And we have followed him down the Greek peninsula to the city of Athens. And in chapter 17, we saw his sermon on Mars Hill in that great city. And then when he left there, he went to the city of Corinth, another great city in its day. Not as well known to us today as the city of Athens, but in that day was a well-known, substantial, significant Greek city. And we are in the midst of learning many of the things that transpired at Corinth and the various lessons that this has for us in our situation today. And so, to that end, we will continue the study, as we remind you that we are dependent upon the gifts of our radio listeners in order to teach God's Word on this station. Well, back to chapter 18, let's just read and comment. Verse 1, after these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome, and he came to them. Now, we don't know all the reasons why he came to them. Obviously, they were Jews, so he had that in common with them. Secondly, we learn, as we read the next verse, which I will in just a moment, that they were both tent makers, so he had that in common with them, but what is not stated is that there was obviously a strong connection in regard to Jesus Christ. And what we're not told is how Aquila and Priscilla became followers of Christ. Did that happen to them when they were in Rome? Did that occur at some other point? Did that take place now when Paul came to them and talked to them about Christ? And was he able to convince them from the scriptures, which they already knew and loved, that Jesus was the promised Messiah and they became followers of Christ? We don't know how that happened, but we do learn in verse 3, so because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they were tent makers. And last Sunday, we talked a great deal about this business of tent making and how Paul received financial support from the churches, missionary support when that was offered. He gladly received it and used that to be involved full-time in gospel ministry. But when that was not available, he would revert or resort, maybe I should say, to the skill that he had been taught as a young man, namely tent making, because all Jewish boys were taught a trade by which they could support themselves, even if they went on into some other field, such as religion, as Paul had, and for a long time was supported in the Jewish religion as a leading Pharisee, and therefore was amply supported by the funds that were available to Jewish religious leaders in his day. And then when he became a Christian, he was supported primarily by the church, the offerings that God's people gave to the Lord through their churches, and that became the means of support for the Apostle Paul as he pursued his preaching ministry among the churches. But when he was sent out from the church in Antioch, where he had been serving as an associate pastor for a number of years, and presumably would have been financially supported by that church, but when he was sent out from that church as a missionary, then his salary would have been terminated, and he would have been dependent upon missionary support. He would have been dependent upon gifts. He would have been dependent upon transfers of money that we would call today missions giving, missions budget, missionary support. And in that day, it wasn't as easy to transfer those funds as it is in our day. I'm amazed at how easy it is to transfer funds today. It's getting easier all the time. We have missionaries in a number of places, and there have been times over the years when we've had some measure of challenge in getting funds to them. That's one of the purposes of a mission board, is to expedite the transfer of funds that come from the churches to the mission board, and then the mission board has set up avenues of transfer to the missionary, which in years gone by sometimes could be quite difficult, quite cumbersome, and often involved a great deal of delay. But that is changing. In days gone by, the missions board would have, in most cases, collected the support from all of the churches and individuals who supported the particular missionary, and I'm, of course, describing the method of independent missions. Denominational missions work a little bit different, and I'll explain that in just a moment, but they would have collected all the funds that come in month by month. They collect them through the month. Let's say through the month of March, they would collect all the funds that come in during the month of March, and then the 1st of April, they would, in the old days, want to do one of two things. Either tally up the support and write a check and mail it, or, what was more common, tally up the funds and make a deposit in a checking account in the bank in the States that the missionary could have access to in his foreign location. But sometimes that would take some time to get the funds from the American bank to the bank on the foreign in the foreign country. Now, a denominational situation is a bit different because there money comes into the denominational headquarters, to the denominational office, to the denominational account, and then generally a salary is paid to the missionaries, which will be based not upon designated contributions to that missionary, but just out of the pool of funds that has come in to support missions in general or the denomination in general. But as far as the transfer funds, it basically turns out to be the same. Now, in our day, it's a whole lot easier. You can actually send funds. It's still, what should I say? You still have to work at it a little bit. I know that even in the course of a few months, it can change. Not too many months ago, we sent funds to a missionary in a location in Africa, and you'll be surprised to hear this, maybe, by going to Walmart and depositing the funds and making the transfer. You say, that is really strange. Well, it is unless you realize that an awful lot of the money that Hispanics send back to their homes, often to Mexico, is done that way. And Walmart is always at the leading edge of whatever's going on. And they seem to be very, very wise at opportunities to provide a service that will also make money for them. Some people find that very disturbing, but I don't. I think that's the way enterprise works. And if somebody can offer a service, then of course it's only proper that they should make a profit from it, which is in this case is generally a very low fee, quite minimal. And if they're charging too much, then let somebody else offer the same service for less. If it can be done for less and still make a profit, still make something from it, then somebody else will do it. If this place is charging too much, that's the way enterprise works. I have no problem with that. I can't understand why some people seem to get all upset that somebody like Walmart is taking advantage of these poor people by charging them a small fee, and it really is a small fee because we've done it. It's not much at all. In fact, it's cheaper than we were able to do it before through the banks. Thank you, Walmart, for providing a reliable service at less cost. That was a great help to us. But even that was done some months ago has changed, and now we've got another way of doing it. I mean, there's so many opportunities today. And I'll give one other illustration before I move on. A few months ago, we were contacted from a man in the United Kingdom, that's in England, who wanted to donate some money to our church for our radio ministry. Thank you so much. We are dependent upon that. He actually listened to messages on the Internet, and we not only place messages on radio stations like the one that most of you are listening to right now, but also we make these same messages available at sermonaudio.com on the Internet, and some people download these all over the world. And some who are hearing this message today may not be hearing it on November 3, the day that it is being designated for to be aired on radio stations. That's the day it will be aired on all the radio stations that we're on, but are hearing it at a different time. It's your convenience, whenever you want to download it. In fact, it could be heard years from now. Sometimes I'll get a contact, I did not too long ago, from somebody, a pastor in Florida, who had listened to a sermon that had been preached, I think, in 2006, and he had some questions, follow up on it, and I had to really think about it because 2006 is a long time ago for me. I can't remember much about that sermon that I preached 7-8 years ago, but he just heard it. It's fresh in his mind, but it's not in mind because he downloaded it from the archive on the Internet and listened to it at his convenience, because there it is waiting for anyone who wants to listen to it. So it's an amazing process, amazing technology that is available to us today. And back to the man from England, he wanted us to send these funds in appreciation for the ministry of the word that he was receiving by Internet. And we didn't have anything set up for that. We do now. But that was new. We'd never had anybody in another country that wanted to send funds to support the Beacon broadcast or the Beacon Pulpit Internet Ministry, which is all in the same budget, so that's what it goes to. The radio budget includes the Internet Ministry, and it's in different forms of basically the same kind of ministry. But we didn't have any way to do it. We've thankfully and gratefully received contributions from American listeners that usually drop a check in the mail. But here was somebody that wanted to send funds from another country, and it really isn't what should I say, it isn't the best procedure to send a check in the mail from another country for several reasons. And from the United Kingdom, it probably wouldn't be a security problem, though it would take a few days to get here and so forth. But the problem with that is when, once you get it here, it's in pounds, and we need it in dollars, and then it's got to be... exchanged. The currency's got to be exchanged. And when you do that in Alamance County, it costs a lot, believe it or not. I've always thought that cost way too much. If you do that in a foreign city, if you do that in an airport, an international airport, it's a reasonable fee. But you do that in Alamance County, where it isn't done very often, and the banks really wallop you on it. It can take a huge amount of the contribution. I've done that a few times over the years, and I finally decided it's just hardly worth it. Unless you've got, you know, like a several thousand dollars, it's just hardly worth it. So we figured up, set up some kind of a wire transfer so that we could receive these funds and the bank would exchange them for us at a reasonable fee. So those are the things that are available today, but that wasn't available to Paul. When churches wanted to support him financially, how did they get the money to him? By courier. That was really the only way. Somebody had to carry the money, and as you know, it's not very wise to send one person alone with money, particularly when it's not a check or bills that you can fold and tuck away. It's almost always going to be in a gold or silver coin in those days, and easily robbed. In fact, just the simple principles of accountability would indicate that two or more people ought to be traveling with this money. That's to safeguard the courier so that he cannot be accused of stealing it. Suppose he does get robbed, and he's alone, and he says, I got robbed. Well, we assume that as a Christian he's telling the truth, but we've had enough experience over the years to know that sometimes even Christians get in bad shape spiritually and will misappropriate funds. And how do we know that he didn't take the money and say that he got robbed, but it was actually he who was robbing Paul or robbing the church? So you want to send two or more. It really becomes quite cumbersome to get that support, that financial support to the missionary, in this case the Apostle Paul. So it didn't always come faithfully and regularly. And here we find Paul having to work to support himself. Back to Acts 18:3, so because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they were tent makers, and, verse 4, he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath, and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. He continued to carry out his ministry, as he always had. I say continued. He inaugurated a preaching ministry in Corinth, as he had in other cities. Here there was a synagogue, one synagogue, just singular. He reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. Everywhere Paul went, he didn't seem to have any difficulty getting an open door to preach in the synagogue. And there was a synagogue in most cities. Certainly cities of any size had a Jewish population and had established a synagogue. And Paul was able to have access to those synagogues until his message of the gospel was rejected, in which case he was booted out of the synagogue. And that's what happened here, as it happened so many other times. But we are told here that he persuaded both Jews and Greeks. This would be the Jewish congregation in the synagogue, the ones you would expect to be in a synagogue, as well as Gentiles who were attending the synagogue and listening to the messages that were preached there and the scriptures that were read there. It's very, very insightful, very, very important to realize that in every city, God had Gentiles in the synagogues. You find it every place that Paul went. It's so common as you read through the book of Acts that maybe sometimes you don't stop to think about how remarkable this is. You say, well, that's just the way it was. Gentiles in every city who worshipped in the synagogue. Uh-huh. How did that happen? When you think about the great divide between Jews and Gentiles, the animosity that was between them, this is not normal. Really now, think it through. This is not normal. Something else is going on here. The Spirit of God is already preparing a Gentile, what should I say, contingency for the Bride of Christ. Jews and Gentiles who are coming to Christ. And they're being prepared for that now. And so every place Paul goes in the synagogue, he is preaching to Jews, he's preaching to Gentiles. Now, at some point, he generally goes outside the synagogue and preaches to Gentiles who have not been worshiping in the synagogue. And in many cases, some of those are saved too. We saw some of those who were saved in Athens, where there was no synagogue, evidently. He didn't preach in one there. But we do read that after Paul preached on Mars Hill, some men joined him and believed, among them Dionysius the Areopagite, a woman named Damaris, and others with them. Others, plural, had to be at least two more, so minimal number of four who believed in Athens, and possibly more, depending on how many people that word others with the S on the end, the plural others, represents. But some believed in Athens, who were Gentiles who had not been worshiping in the synagogue, who didn't seem to have a background for this, who heard Paul's message on Mars Hill, where he was talking to people who had no knowledge of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the Old Testament scriptures. And Paul would reach out to those people, but not at the beginning. He always went to the synagogues first. You say, why? Well, there was both a spiritual reason, if you want to call it that, a divine reason, and a logical reason. The spiritual reason was because that's what Jesus told him to do. And Paul said so. He said this is what he carried out to the Jew first and also to the Greek. This was his assignment. Jew first. Jews first. And Paul carried that burden. Read about it in Romans chapter 9 and Romans chapter 11. Paul had a great burden for the Jews, which was, of course, his own nation. And so he always went to the synagogue to carry out this divine assignment to the Jew first. And he was able to start on his second assignment and also to the Greek in the synagogue because God had Greeks there as well. So Jew first, and also to the Greek, he could take care of that, at least initially, at the synagogue of every city he went to where there was a synagogue that was open to him. But he went beyond that. He didn't just confine himself to the synagogue. When he got booted out of the synagogue, he would preach the gospel to others as well. But in this case, he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. We're not really told if that word persuaded means successfully persuaded or just endeavored to persuade. I would take it that it's probably a little bit of both. Some he successfully persuaded. He seemed to be able to do that by the work of the Spirit of God in every synagogue he preached in, or virtually every. But in most cases, the majority were not successfully persuaded. He endeavored to persuade them, but they did not believe. But at any rate, he did that. We don't know how many Sabbath days he preached in the synagogue at Corinth. It had to be multiple Sabbaths. He reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath. That sounds like certainly more than one, and it really sounds like more than two or three when you're talking about every Sabbath. It's indicating a pattern that is established here in the city of Corinth, similar to patterns he had established elsewhere. This was his pattern, to go into the synagogue and basically preach as long as he was able. Sometimes a matter of a few weeks, sometimes a matter of a few months, but as long as he was able, he stayed in the synagogue and preached to the congregation there until something happened. Until people either believed him or vehemently rejected him and kicked him out. And in almost every place he went, he got some of both of that. Remember the great exception that took place in Berea, that is so different that it is noted as being remarkable. These were more noble than those in Thessalonica in that they searched the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. They didn't ever get to the place where they vehemently rejected him. When Paul was run out of Berea, it was not because of Bereans. It was because of Thessalonians who traveled to Berea, the same ones who had rejected him in the synagogue at Thessalonica, traveled to Berea and stirred up trouble there and got him booted out of Berea, but it wasn't because of the synagogue congregation in Berea. I don't know how long he would have been able to continue preaching in the synagogue at Berea if he hadn't had this outside interference from those who traveled from Thessalonica. But the indication is that he had a pretty good run at the synagogue in Corinth. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks. Now, notice verse 5, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. Now, something's taking place here. We're not given enough details to be certain about exactly what it is, but there's an indication here that when Paul received reinforcements from Silas and Timothy, up until this time he was by himself, when he received reinforcements, the companionship, the team work, the prayer support, and I'm convinced also financial support that came from Silas and Timothy, who are traveling to him, no doubt carrying funds, again, gold and silver coins, no doubt, that have been contributed by the churches of Macedonia, Philippi for sure, and probably the others as well, and carried by two people, for the reasons that I've already mentioned. But when they came, Paul was more driven to preach more boldly. That's what we're told. When they came, Paul was compelled by the Spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. Apparently, up until now, he'd just been laying groundwork. I'm just getting little hints of what's going on here. Because now, after some weeks, when Timothy and Silas arrive, Paul testifies that Jesus is the Christ. Up until now, he no doubt had just been giving the general characteristics of the promised Messiah and laying the groundwork to be able to identify Jesus as the one who meets these characteristics. Well, we'll take it up again, Lord willing, next Sunday. Please join me then. Until then, Greg Barkman saying good day. May God give you his eternal peace.